The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren Legiudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy, New York City. Now, how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I am in Denver. This is the last stop of the United States of Misfits tour. It's been incredible. I've learned so much, and I'm actually going to do a solo cast next episode with all the things I learned and all the mistakes I made, so you don't have to. So that, well, look out for that coming in about 2 weeks. So yeah, I'm here and I'm doing a show tonight in Denver at Rise Comedy Theater, and the whole weekend I've been doing bits and pieces of that and doing some hosting and some teaching at the Untangling Our Roots Conference, which is for people who were adopted, donor conceived, not parent expected, et cetera, et cetera. I was donor conceived, if you don't know that. I found out 4 years ago. I joke a lot about it on stage. So I'm here, and I have seen and am inspired by humor having the capacity to heal. Yeah, I did a humor workshop. I taught a few things to some people who are not performers. They're not comedians at all in the slightest. They're people who have a story to tell, and they wanted to bring some humor and lightness to that. And I saw firsthand, I saw people blossom in front of me and be able to share something with humor that they've never been able to share before. And someone came up to me today and she's like, I never thought I could be funny. And she was funny, and she was able to laugh about something. She said, I never thought I could laugh about this. So I was really, really inspired by that, really touched by that. And it makes me believe in comedy. Like, that's what we're doing at the Misfit Variety Show. We're giving comedy and commiseration to people who feel like they don't quite fit. And this community surely feels like they don't quite fit with their stories. So I'm so honored to be a part of it and honored to be able to contribute in this way. And fingers crossed for tonight. It looks like we're going to get a great crowd. And then let's see what we're going to do in the future. It looks bright. Now, before we go into the interview with producer Daniel Powell, quick reminder, remember to rate and review the podcast. Social proof is really important for Misfits because Misfits trust other Misfits to know what's good. Also, sign up at laurenlogie.com to get monthly updates on the podcast. And you can also sponsor a podcast. We've made it accessible for individuals and small companies to be able to sponsor a podcast episode. We put this out about every other week-ish. And if we had a sponsor, we could put it out more often. So to find out more, click on laurenlogie.com, go to Listen Podcast, and contact us there. Today, we're going to hear from producer and director Daniel Powell. Now, how I look for people for this podcast is I look for projects that I'm inspired by, that I feel like have the Misfit voice, give voice to people who might be misunderstood. And I see who was involved with that. And a lot of that is comedy and sketch in particular. And one name that kept coming up was Daniel Powell. In fact, Grace Edwards, who was a guest in an episode in December, she mentioned Daniel as being influential in her career. So his name kept coming up, and I'm so excited that he agreed to be on the podcast, and he has a lot of insight about his journey that I think you can use for yours. Without further ado, let's hear from producer and director Daniel Powell. Thank you, Dan Powell, for joining us on Misfits Making It.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you started at UCB, right?
Yeah, I kind of came up through UCB. I had a day job at Comedy Central at the time. When I first moved to New York, I was an assistant in the talent department at Comedy Central.
Wow.
Made very little money and, you know, would go stand in line for the free shows at UCB on Sunday nights, their ASCAT show. And mm-hmm. And then eventually watching those made me want to take classes. So I started taking classes there and was on a Herald team for a couple of years in the early 2000s. And then eventually it kind of became a conflict of interest to perform at the theater because I was at the Daily Show for a couple of years as a producer, and it was fine to perform and produce at the Daily Show. But when I took a job as a development executive at Comedy Central and I was a buyer, it became a conflict of interest to also be like a writer performer. So I stopped doing that. I was also not very good at it. So it didn't really make sense for me to continue. And yeah, but I loved the theater. I loved my experience there. And I met a lot of people that I still work with today. And it was very formative in terms of like my comedy experience.
How did you get involved with Comedy Central as a talent assistant?
Well, funny you mentioned that. I moved to New York specifically to try and work in independent film. This is, you know, the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And so around the tail end of the big like Miramax boom and the New York-centric mm-hmm. indie film boom. And I interned at Good Machine, which was sort of a predecessor to Focus Films. But I mean, Good Machine at the time had like Ted Hope, Anthony Bregman, Ross Katz, David Lindy, James Shamus was there. And they were making movies with, you know, Todd Solondz and Ang Lee and all in Nicole Holofcener, all these incredible filmmakers. And I wanted to be part of that. And I moved to New York, and then I was really hoping to get a job as Ted Hope's assistant, and it did not work out. And so suddenly I'm in New York. I signed a lease. I do not have a job or any immediate prospects. So I went and I temped, and I told the temp agency that I liked independent film and comedy because I'd done some comedy writing in college and improv there. Mm-hmm. And within about a week, I guess maybe they just remembered, oh, this guy said he liked comedy, because it was probably at the time a rare thing to say to a temp agency. And I was just by sheer luck, I was placed at Comedy Central in the development department, and they had an opening in talent, which is very closely aligned with development. And so after a few weeks of PAing at TV Funhouse, the Robert Smigel show for Comedy Central, mm-hmm. I landed a full-time job in talent relations, and it was fun. I learned through my bosses, Naomi Steinberg and Chris Young and Joanne Grigioni, learned a ton about stand-up comedy, and it was just a crash course and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about stand-up comedy?
I mean, back then, you know, it was sort of like this time at Comedy Central where they were co-owned by both HBO and Viacom. So it was a little bit of like, mm-hmm. Comedy Central was very independent. And my bosses were like, look, we know your salary is shit, but if you want to mm-hmm. put in some extra hours, you can go scout at comedy shows and you can put in for overtime, which I'm sure would never fly now, but back mm-hmm. then did. And so a good chunk of my salary was just going out to all the, not just comedy clubs, but all the, you know, alternative comedy shows that would be in bars and places like UCB or mm-hmm. some of the other theaters, and just learning about how open mics work, how bringer shows work. My first ever stand-up mm-hmm. show, I saw Jerry Seinfeld, I think, when I was in college at like a traditional theater venue.
Wow.
But my very first day at Comedy Central was a Monday, and everyone was like, are you going to go to Luna Lounge? And I'm like, I don't know what that is. They're like, are you serious? You work for Naomi yeah. Steinberg and you don't know? She was Naomi Frisch back then, but like, they were like, you work for Naomi and you don't know what Luna Lounge is? And I was like, I just started today. So Naomi made sure I had seats right up front. And, you know, Luna Lounge that day, the lineup was, and keep in mind, this is like 2000, but it was Dave Chappelle, Jon Stewart, Louis C.K., Marc Maron, Wanda Sykes, and then a few other people who have sort of since disappeared a little bit. But, and even then I realized like, oh, this is an incredible lineup. Obviously now, you know, like the ticket mm-hmm. for a show like that, Louis excluded, would be preposterous. And, you know, Luna was a little, it's probably 200 people total, maybe 150 in the back room of a sort of bar venue. Now, unfortunately, it's like a hotel. Yeah. All those old venues have gone away. But that was my very, very first New York stand-up show, and I will never forget it.
Hell yeah. I mean, that's, you have such a New York story. Like, you came here sort of like back to the wall, didn't know what else to do, like told someone, and then you like, you know, got the opportunity, and it's super cool because that New York is beautiful for that. Is whereas if you come very earnestly, like putting yourself into something, like opportunities tend to appear in New York.
Yeah. I mean, I look back at those days very fondly. I was living in a apartment with three other guys, and it was not, they called it a two bedroom, but what it really was it was clearly a studio apartment that they put in like two drywall pressure walls into and made into a fake two bedroom. And so four 22-year-old men had no business living there. It was absolutely disgusting, but it was, you know, and that's the only way we could afford it with the amount of money we were making. So
I mean, and then New York still, like, people talk about, like, New York's changed and it's a lot more expensive place, a more difficult place to come up. But I do feel like there is still that magic. There is still the ability to go there and, you know, have like these opportunities just kind of fall because everyone's so concentrated in one place.
I mean, that's what makes it so great for stand up because it's like, mm-hmm. you know, in addition to just the population of the city and people being out and wanting to see comedy on any night of the week, which might be harder in smaller markets, you just have so many places where you can do comedy within walking distance of each other. So if you're really trying to make it as a comic and you want to get stage time multiple times a night, you can really, I mean, if you really hustle, you can get on stage like 3-4 times a night, 6-7 mm-hmm. nights a week. And, you know, that of course, as an art form, stand-up comedy requires you working your material out in front of audiences. Yep. And so it is a great place to learn the craft.
Absolutely. And so you're at UCB and then Comedy Central, where was the timeline until you started being involved with like every sketch comedy show on television? How long did that take?
Yeah, I've had such a weird career in that I've been like tangentially involved with, you know, for example, I never worked at Saturday Night Live, but I worked for Robert Smigel, who did the TV Funhouse cartoons on SNL. Mm-hmm. And I was a contributing writer to a handful of those just because Robert was one of my first bosses. And so that was my very first writing credit was for a TV Funhouse cartoon on SNL. So technically I've gotten some jokes on the show, even though I was never actually a stand-up mm-hmm. there. And then later I covered as a development exec, worked on the development of Dimitri Martin's show, Important Things with Dimitri Martin, which Jon Stewart was an executive producer of, and my old boss, Rich Corson, helped develop. I left Comedy Central in 2009. I'd been a development exec for about 5 years. And mm-hmm. I realized that it was not really what I wanted to do with my life, was to be on the executive side. I had developed an animated series called Ugly Americans that I sort of bought mm-hmm. a web series from a young man named Devin Clark. And we had gotten it over the period of years from a web series that starred Nick Kroll and John Mulaney and Pete Holmes, who were, you know, mm-hmm. like probably brilliant. Making like $100 per episode back then, to, you know, a full series pickup. And I decided that I wanted to go help produce the show rather than stay at the network. And mm-hmm. that was really my, so, you know, even though I'd been on the show side at The Daily Show, that was very much as like a junior producer, you know, a researcher, then an associate producer. And when I left Comedy Central 5 years later, it was as an EP. So it was sort of nice that I got to kind of skip to the head of the line a little bit in terms of my experience. But after Ugly Americans, which, you know, ran for a couple of years, it actually had 31 mm-hmm. episodes, which back then on Comedy Central was like a Friends length run. It's like almost everything on Comedy Central got 2 seasons at most and then was canceled back then. But especially the animated shows, hardly anything made it. There was basically Drawn Together and then Us. I had met a lot of comics and people as a development exec. And one of the comics I met was Amy Schumer. We mm-hmm. met on a reality show that we actually did during the last writer's strike back in 2007, 2008, because we couldn't do scripted. Amy and I got along very well. And a few years later, she was blowing up because of her appearances on The Roasts. I think The Roast mm-hmm. of Charlie Sheen and The Roast of Roseanne. And they gave her a blind pilot commitment, which was, you know, you don't even have to pitch. We know we want to do a show with you. Just figure out what that show is. Come in and pitch it. We'll make a pilot. And they were like, first step, find a producer. So she DM'd me on you know, when a Google chat or whatever, and was like, "Hey, you're going to produce my TV show." She didn't even ask. She just told me. And I was like, I actually had some downtime because Ugly Americans was in animation, which, you know, takes some time in Canada being animated. The episodes were written and recorded. So I was like, yeah, I have time. Let's do it. And that show ended up becoming Inside Amy Schumer, which really helped, you know, jumpstart my career as a producer in a way that Ugly Americans hadn't quite done. And that's how I was able to start my company. That's how I was able to get the money together to direct my first film. And so my company, Irony Point, which, you know, was just a vanity card during the Schumer years. When we finished the fourth season in 2016, and Amy was like, I, even though we were contracted for a fifth season, she had a bunch of movie offers and her career had exploded, wanted to take a break and come back to it. So I used that time and then the money that I made from the show to really turn my company into less of a one-man operation, more of a full-fledged production, you know, a real production company. And we started small. We started with like web series and small pilots for Comedy Central. Our first big show was The Break with Michelle Wolf on Netflix.
I love that. I've watched like every episode. I mean, I've watched every episode of Amy Schumer as well, but
thank you. I'm really proud of The Break, and, you know, Christine Engel and Michelle and I worked on that show. And I just, unfortunately, it was a little bit of Netflix's failed experiment in topical weekly shows, which the platform is not really built for. They also did, you know, right around the same time, Joel McHale's show they attempted, which was like a reimagining of The Soup. That did not continue. We did not continue. They kept on Patriot Act for one or two more seasons, but really the interface is really built for like binging and not for topical weekly shows, which we found out pretty quickly. And it was disappointing because we were really proud of it. But it did help establish my relationship with Netflix. And our next show for them was I Think You Should Leave, which was already sold. But they were having trouble finding a production company who would do it for the budget. And since The Break was on its way out, we raised our hand. And so that was I Think You Should Leave. And then later on, Michael Che and I share a manager, and I'm just a huge fan of him. So we ended up working on That Damn Michael Che, which is a show, if anyone is listening and has not seen That Damn Michael Che, it was sort of quietly released on HBO Max, and which is now Max, I guess. It's two seasons. I'm so proud of it. I think it's such a great show. I really wish it hadn't flown so under the radar. And then, and I also did Astronomy Club with Netflix, and that was, you know, I knew a lot of the group from other projects, and they had actually asked me to help them develop the show for Comedy Central, because they did some initial sketches for Comedy Central Digital. Comedy Central solicited the pitch. We developed the half-hour version, and then we went in and pitched it. The pitch went great. And then like 2 weeks later, they're like, yeah, we're sorry. We're just not really going to do sketch anymore. And it's like, you asked for the pitch. Like, we didn't approach you. You asked for this. And it was such a bummer because at the time, no one else besides Netflix was really doing sketch. So we're like, there are like three places that we can even take this to. But fortunately, Kenya Barris caught wind of it. And at the time, he had that massive deal with Netflix. So he made the calls necessary so that basically by the time that we walked into Netflix, we'd already been picked up. And that's purely all credit to Kenya. That was purely him believing in the team and throwing his weight around. And again, that's a show that has like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm incredibly proud of, but, was for whatever reason, the Netflix algorithm just didn't serve it up to the right people or what have you. And it was not able to move forward. So I've worked on a lot of sketch. I'm very proud of every single show, but it is funny. Like some of them, like Inside Amy and I Think You Should Leave, have cut through the clutter and become phenomenons in their time. And, you know, That Damn Michael Che, Astronomy Club, and, you know, some of the other stuff has been, I think, very critically well received, but didn't necessarily ride that wave.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many intangibles.
Well, yeah. So many. Alex Blagg was on this podcast. And he did a Problematic with Moshe Kasher, and he was talking about how much like they realized as they were editing that, oh no, this is not the network for us. This is not the place to be releasing this. They want something that this show isn't. And so that it never didn't work. Did you find, I mean, it sounds like that's somewhat a factor that you found, that if it wasn't the right space for a project, like with the break, it's hard to get out there.
I mean, look, I will say this. I've been incredibly fortunate in that I think part of it was because I had been a development executive at Comedy Central, and so had Jesse Klein, who was the head writer and co-showrunner of Inside Amy Schumer. Because Jesse and I were executives in that specific department, the East Coast Development Department, they just gave us so much leeway and they were so deferential. And so we did get notes, but I will say we did not get nearly as many notes on that on Inside Amy Schumer as like I think a lot of other shows did.
Oh, wow.
So Netflix, you know, as much as it's frustrating to sort of be in the hands of the algorithm, which is this like inscrutable, you know, machine and lines of code as opposed to a human being, I will say all the development execs there, I've had nothing but good experiences with, and they're very hands-off. They will give notes, but ultimately their sort of philosophy is like, we bought the show because we trust you and we're going to give you non-prescriptive notes that you're free to take. But then ultimately it is sort of sink or swim, you know, which we found with the break. And candidly, I think the issues at the break were not about like the brand or, oh, we're not on the same page as the network execs. It was more just literally the interface had always been built for all episodes are released at once. And they didn't have really a means of yelling at people like, hey, there's a new episode every week on the platform because, and that's really what you have to do in the early days of a show that's weekly because, you know, look at Conan, look at really any late night show, you know, even the established ones, when a new host took over, it takes years to build an audience. And if you're getting 10 weeks on a platform that's not built for weekly releases, that it became like impossible. But creatively, I mean, they let us do some stuff. I think The Break with Michelle Wolf to this day has the most like pro-abortion comedy segment that's ever been put on a major media platform, which I'm very proud of. And and Astronomy Club, they really let us make the shows we want. And of course, I Think You Should Leave. I mean, can you imagine if they tried to note that show? Like most of the notes on I Think You Should Leave are, and by the way, I'm not a creative producer on that. I'm a production management executive. But I see the notes and they tend to be, hey, this sketch is a little long. We're like, hey, if you're looking to cut one, maybe this wasn't our favorite, but it's not like they go in and give line item notes, you know?
Well, the title of producer, for those who might be listening, who might be in other areas of the creative world, how would you explain what you do as a producer?
Sure. I mean, I'm sure you watch credits and you see all the different types of producers and they vary. My role depends from show to show, like on Inside Amy Schumer or Astronomy Club or Life and Beth, which I'm currently working on. I am a creative producer. I'm there in the writer's room. I work I help staff the writer's room. I work very closely with the creators and the other EPs to really, you know, figure out the creative of the show. And then I also do oversee from an administrative perspective, like production management in terms of the hiring of the department heads and the schedule, the budget, things like that. There are other shows like That Damn Michael Che or I Think You Should Leave where they've hired my company, Irony Point, to help execute the production. And so I'm much more involved in like production logistics and I'm not really necessarily involved in the creative. If, you know, if they ask me my opinion, I'm happy to give it, but I like to stay in my appropriate lane when I'm hired for a job and not, you know, try to insert myself in a place where I don't belong on that specific show. So I have I have a weird career where I do bounce between creative producing and production management. And then also sometimes I write and direct and, you know, I have a small feature career as well. But in this day and age, especially with what's going on with the strikes, I've just found that the more skill sets, the better in terms of like just being able to stay afloat.
Yeah. Hell yeah. And how do you know to say yes to a job?
That is a very good question. I mean, a lot of times, scheduling and if I'm even available is a big part of it. I would say mostly it just tends to be my gut instinct on if I really believe in the talent, and I feel like it's going to be something that's creatively interesting. And, you know, this is a very talent or comedy mm-hmm. is so talent oriented. And so really, is it like, am I a fan of this talent? Do I believe in them? And do I personally get along with them? Because a lot of it is just like, you have to vibe with the people that you're going to spend an insane number of hours, possibly, you know, for years. It really is, a lot of it is just gut. And sometimes it's, well, you know what? I was about to say sometimes it's wrong, but like, honestly, there are very few jobs that I go look back at, including the shows that quote unquote failed or did not get renewed when we were hoping they would. There are very few shows where I look back and I'm like, I regret doing that. You know, even the failures, and again, I'm using failures in the commercial sense, not the creative sense, because there are a few things I look at and I'm like, we blew it.
Right. I mean, because the stuff that didn't commercial, like, they have cult followings of people who are rabid fans. So,
yeah. And look, I mean, the fact that you watched The Break and you remember it and you were a fan of it is very meaningful to me. And I'm as proud of that. You know, that poster still hangs proudly in my office. It doesn't, I don't judge how I view the work I've done based on, like, you know, the perception of its commercial performance. That's not why I'm in this business. But the other thing is that,
We talk about that a lot.
I mean, you learn so much from the shows that don't work. I learned so much about how Netflix works from The Break. And also, without The Break, I wouldn't have been able to work on I Think You Should Leave. And my company would not have had the chance to work on that show, which has sort of become Irony Point's flagship show and sort of brand definer. So also, like, the show I worked on, the first show I worked on with Amy Schumer was a strike show. It was a reality unscripted show we did during the 2007 strike. It was not good. It was quickly swept under the rug by Comedy Central. But had we not done it, I wouldn't have met Amy, and the course of my career would have been very different. So every single thing, I did a show for Go 90, which very quickly folded. It was the hardest production because we had no money. I think everyone was kind of like bummed out about how difficult the production was. The show actually turned out very well, although again, Go 90 is now defunct. But on that show, I met Josh Rubin, and I later produced his movie, which went to Sundance. I met Bridie Elliott and helped finance a feature of hers that went to Sundance. And so even though it was like a little Go 90 show that I'm sure the viewership was in like the hundreds, it led to so many cool things. So you just really have to like look at the bigger picture of, you know, you have to look beyond like success or failure and just look at how one thing leads to another.
And especially because things you don't know how it's going to turn out. A lot of people come on here and talk about that. Like, they just have learned to just like, commercial success means one thing, but like you just drive yourself mad if that's your barometer that you live by, because it can drive you nuts.
It's purely impossible to know years ahead of time if something is going to be a commercial success, because, you know, though you can probably tell this has the potential to be good, but there are also like so many things can go wrong along the way. And even the best intentions you can get the best group of people together and somehow it just doesn't work creatively. Mm-hmm. But then even beyond the creative execution, there's also so many intangibles of like, what's in the zeitgeist, what's in the conversation. I mean, it's all the same things that lead to like, does something win an Academy Award? Does a tweet go viral? Does a sketch go viral? Like, you have no control over it. And you just have to make stuff. You have to go into everything. This is something we learned at UCB. Work at the top of your intelligence. Always just try to make everything as strong as possible. Go in with the best intentions and in good faith. And sometimes those things will work and sometimes they won't. You just have to acknowledge a lot of it is out of your control.
So you came up in UCB and you were testing sketches with the ability to refine them based on audience feedback. Then you're in like a room and you're going to put it on tape, on film, and then put it out there. I mean, because you don't get an audience to test your material out of when you're doing a sketch television show. Any tips on how you figure out if it's funny before you?
Sure. Well, you know, let's take Inside Amy. When we did that show, we would, you know, everyone would pitch sketches. Amy and Jesse and I would go back. We'd pick the ones that we felt, and by pitch, they meant, I mean, the idea of the sketch. They wouldn't like come to the table with the sketch and read it. We would just pitch ideas. The executive producers would step aside, pick the ones that we wanted to potentially move forward with. We'd go back in the room, and then before we sent a writer to draft, we would spend probably about like 30 to 40 minutes per idea with everyone just doing a blue sky brainstorm, pitching them all sorts of ideas so that they could walk away from the table with like 3 to 4 pages of notes. And we would also let them sort of lead the way, like, you know, all right, here's what I'm seeing. I have the beginning. I don't know what the ending would be, so that, you know, they give sort of guidance to the back session. Then they would write a draft. The EPs would give notes. Sometimes after a first draft, it's like, this isn't working. We just kill it. But like, you know, EPs would give notes. And usually around the second draft, we would read it aloud at the table. And so the out loud table reads are really, whether it's a sketch or a feature film or really any project, hearing it out loud is the most important barometer of whether it's working or not. You can, you know, we would read it at the table, assigning parts to the writers. And then later, as we got down the road, Amy and our fellow EP, Kevin Kane, they'd founded a theater group called The Collective in New York. And a lot of the members were like recurring on the show. And we would go to like their weekly meetings, and basically they were very cool about letting the show sort of take over their weekly meetings when we were in production. And we would read the sketches with The Collective reading the parts. And so, you know, then we were able to get out of the writer's room, workshop them in front of, you know, not a paying audience, but like, you know, an audience of people that were like-minded, and we would learn a lot from that as well. So by the time we got on set and we were shooting a sketch, we'd really like heard it out loud probably at least a dozen times, and worked through every joke, you know. And at the end of part of the table read process in the writer's room was we'd read it out loud, and then we would put it up on the screen, and we'd really go through line by line and try to like refine every joke. And, you know, cause we didn't have a lot of time to improvise. You know, it's Comedy Central. We didn't have a lot of money. We had to shoot two sketches a day. We did sometimes, but it wasn't like, hey, we'll figure it out on set. You know, it was not like that. We had to, we had to get through, like, this sketch has to be done by lunch. Like, you know,
that, I mean, that show shows, that's why it's so good. It's like all of that. You had all that workout time.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, though, on the other hand, it sounds like we did. I will say this. We really, our work hours, and this is going to be infuriating, but we worked from like 11 to 4. A big part of the ethos of the Inside Amy Schumer room was like, when we're there, we will work. We're not, you know, like we're working. We're in the room. Obviously, we took a lunch break, but or we just ordered lunch and had it at the table. But it wasn't one of these rooms where it's like, we are there 14 hours a day when we're in production. Mm-hmm. Big part of the ethos of it was like, in order to come up with ideas for the show, relatable ideas, you have to be out there in the real world. You have to be living your life. You have to be dating, you know, like hanging out. You can't live your life in a writer's room, or else you see on certain shows where the comedians clearly never leave a writer's room, where the snake starts to eat its tail, and the show becomes about the experience of like being in a writer's room, oddly, and it becomes very meta. And so, look, we worked very hard, but I feel like we also worked very smartly, and we tried to keep the hours reasonable. And we just felt like you can very easily pack what other rooms are doing in 10-hour days into like a 5-hour day if you just concentrate.
Bravo. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you can, and again, like that show is so of the moment. And so, yeah, you could totally see that like in the proofs and in the
It was wild. I was, you know, when I was at the Daily Show, that was like, it was Jon's third season and fourth season. And I got to sort of be there as a junior staffer watching as we started to win Emmys and the show sort of blew up and became like this cultural phenomenon in the way that it had never been with Craig Kilborn. But of course, I was, you know, I was a junior staffer, so I was really watching John and Ben Carlin and the senior DJ Jaberbaum just sort of ride this wave. And then I got to sort of experience a very similar thing. Yeah, you know, not everyone remembers, but like seasons 2 and 3 of Inside Amy Schumer, like every single sketch was having think pieces written about it, and fresh off Trainwreck, and had just become this huge star. And it was fun, you know. And I was doing it with Jesse Klein. Was one of my best friends. And so getting to do it with one of my best friends, of course, Amy is a good friend who I'd known for years. So it was, and you know, a lot of the writers, Christine Nangle, Tammy Sager, were people that were just the most fun people. So getting to not only getting to work on a show that was doing well in that way and riding the sort of cultural wave was great, but also being able to hang out with your friends every day is even better.
Were you involved with the reboot that didn't end up? Were you also producing that?
Yeah, I was. It won the Writers Guild Award. We beat Saturday Night Live and some other shows. You know, unfortunately, they aired it on Paramount Plus instead of Comedy Central.
Yeah,
and that network. I think several years ago, when they ordered the fifth season, or you know, the fifth season had already been picked up, but they were like, "Look, we're calling in." We're calling in the long-awaited fifth season. I think they really wanted it as a launch stunt for Paramount Plus, the new streaming network. And in the years that they decided to do it to when it aired, the Paramount brand has really become like the Yellowstone channel. Middle-aged men, political persuasion. I don't know if Inside Amy Schumer is really their bag.
Yeah, fair choice.
I don't know how many people saw that this season, but it was certainly well received in comedy writing circles, and I'm proud of the Writers Guild Award and how. But you know, it obviously did not have the same cultural resonance. But I also just don't know who has Paramount Plus.
Yeah, it's someone's uncle. That's often. Yeah.
Well, we're hoping that the entire 5-season run will eventually be licensed out to. You know, obviously Paramount Global owns it, but they're starting to they license Key and Peele to Netflix, and we're hoping that once the strike is over, they'll start circulating it as a license. Yeah.
I got to, so I auditioned for like 85 things for that season. So it was enjoyable, at least to just be involved with the material. It's so fun to just play with really fun material.
For season 5?
Yeah. Like Hysterical Neighbor or, you know, what have you.
Abortion, for 3. I didn't know that. I'm sorry. You know, Gail Keller does our casting. And to be perfectly candid, Amy and Kevin are actors and they, you know, sometimes I'll write something and I'll suggest someone for the role or I'll suggest some people, but Amy and Kevin really, this is me blaming you're not being cast.
I didn't even put that together until we started talking about it. I was like, oh yeah, the fifth season. I know about that. Yeah. Fine. No, I mean,
for those of you out there who have not seen it, unfortunately you cannot see it right now because it's temporarily off, at least it's off the air while Paramount Plus seeks a licensee. Mm-hmm. But at some point it will be like, oh wait, you can also buy it on iTunes. It is available on iTunes.
Yeah.
So if you want to pay $1 per episode, I'm really proud of the fifth season and it was only 5 episodes. Mm-hmm. And I've actually had a number of people reach out. It's still on planes. You can watch it on an airplane.
Let's check that. That's
and
fun.
I've had a number of people reach out and be like, hey, I just caught the fifth season on a plane. I didn't even know it was happening. And it's still so fun. And you know, so it's nice that you're like, oh, I stumbled onto it and it really made me laugh.
Yeah. That's great. So we always ask people their misfit moment, the moment when you knew that the traditional world was not for you.
I will just say I went to college to be in politics. I was majoring in government and politics, which I can't even – seems like such a different life and a lifetime ago. But – yeah. I mean, obviously political culture at the time was not nearly as insane as it is now, but I obviously dodged a huge bullet. But I just started getting bored with it and not caring. And for the longest time, I was going to move to DC and work in public policy, work as a Senate staffer or something like that. That was the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started writing for... maybe because I was so bored, I went in to check out the College Humor magazine where I went to school. And this is true. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to name drop because it is cool. The editor-in-chief were Chris Miller and Phil Lord, who made the Lego movie and 21 Jump Street, Spider-Verse films. And I met them and I sort of just became hooked on writing for the Humor magazine. And I ended up taking over from them when they graduated. And that sort of became... the moment where I'm like, okay, this is really what I'm doing. And so I felt bad because really my college experience, the most like really the thing that college did for me was like, not, it was not a single class. In fact, I'm sort of shocked I graduated, but it was writing for the college humor magazine and doing, working in the, I joined the improv group there and I was in the improv group, which Chris was like, I don't think Phil was in it, but Chris Miller was also in it. And, some other notable names who I will not name drop here, but, that's really where my trajectory changed. And so by the time, but again, even when I left college, mm-hmm. I was more like, well, that's not a career. That's a hobby. I was, I'd switched my major to film and indie film was the focus as a career. But then as it turns out, it can be a career. So Comedy Central was really my home for the first 15 years between The Daily Show, the executive side, being an assistant, Ugly Americans, Inside Amy Schumer. Mm-hmm. That was like a 16-year run. And then when I started my company in earnest, then I expanded my relationships to Netflix and now Hulu and HBO. And, you know, we work now with Broadway Video and some stuff. And it's great because, you know, even though in this era of like media consolidation, one thing I've learned is that like, and this is a huge lesson, which is a company cannot be loyal to you. I mean, I no longer recognize what Comedy Central is and hardly anyone that I came up with is there, but people can be loyal. So, I mean, really in this business, it's about cultivating your relationships with people, but you can't cultivate a relationship with a company because that company might not even exist. And a company by definition can't be loyal to you.
Yeah. What's cool that you were majoring in politics, but the stuff you've worked on has had such a political effect, giving voice to people and making us feel less crazy because of the political situation. So it's cool how it like sort of like it did loop back for you in a way.
It did feel when I was at The Daily Show, especially that like, oh, this is sort of a cool merger of all my interests. And it certainly like helped validate my career choice in the eyes of my parents. The TV Funhouse stuff definitely concerned them early on because that stuff was like filthy. And they're from the mid, they're very sweet people from the Midwest. They're used to it now. But no, The Daily Show was definitely like a very esteemed way to get into comedy.
Yeah. So when the moment you two, when you formed your company as well, you were going to make it a big operation. It's a huge step. What was that like for you?
When we finished that run of Inside Amy Schumer, the fourth season in 2016, I did still have that itch of like, I've been here for a while. I came here to work in indie film and I have not made a single movie. Mm-hmm. So I basically scraped together some of the money that I'd made and called in a bunch of favors. I wrote with a friend, my friend Liz, a very small feature. It was a drama. It was a musical drama called Bex. And we just went ahead and made it. You know, it was one of those things where it's like, let's just make it. We have the resources. And it did pretty well. It won the LA Film Festival and, mm-hmm. or it did well critically. Won the LA Film Festival and got distribution, you know, and I still have people who mention it to me. Obviously, it was not like a huge commercial success, but really one of the great things about it was the woman who produced it, Alex Bach, was so incredibly good at her job. You know, this was not a big budget movie. She had won the Cassavetes Award for one of Jim McKay's films, which is the Independent Spirit Award Best Picture under $500,000. And so she obviously knew how to make a movie like this. And at the time in New York, there was this company, Jax Media, Tony Hernandez's outfit, that was doing most of the comedy production in New York. And basically everyone would go to Tony as their first choice. And then there was no second choice because they would come to me and they'd be like, hey, Jax can't do this. Or Tony, they either can't do it or there's a contractual conflict or something like that. Can you do it? And I would always be like, guys, I'm not a line producer. Like I'm a creative producer. It's a different thing. But it started to happen frequently enough that I was like, all right, there's clearly a vacuum in the market here for like maybe a smaller version of Jax or what Jax had been 6 or 7 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And Alex's husband, Jake, actually worked for Jax. That's how we met. He was, you know, I was basically like, should we do something here? And we partnered up. And again, we started small. We did not start in any meaningful way as a competitor to Jax. That's how I felt comfortable about it. we started, you know, doing very small stuff and then just sort of built our way up. We're still a small privately owned company. There are about nine of us. We're not owned by any major media conglomerates, which can make it a struggle, especially like right now during the strike. It's not super easy, but it also allows us a great deal of control and allows us to pick and choose the methods we want to do. And we don't have an obligation. I don't have to do like quarterly reports to my corporate business, you know?
Yeah. And so you have another film, Scare Me. So do you feel like film, this is kind of something you want to push forward in the future?
Yeah, I mean, if I could make, I could produce or direct one movie a year, I would be, and, you know, make most of my money in TV, I would be incredibly happy. I love films. I love TV. We sort of live in this amazing era where, you know, in spite of all the problems that are being highlighted by the strike right now, we're also living in this era where, like, I mean, look at the TV that's getting made. TV used to be like, movie stars wouldn't even, you know, TV was where you went for careers to die. And now look at the stuff that's being made. It's just absolutely incredible. Yeah. We're so spoiled with like the best television in history. And so it's like, all right, if you have an idea for a project, what's the most appropriate medium? Is it a 90-minute feature? Is it a limited series? Is it ongoing episodic? Is it short form? One of my favorite things I've ever made was a digital series for Topic. It was five-minute episodes that Scirocco Dunlap produced. She currently has a show that she created for Amazon that Natasha Lyonne and Maya Rudolph are producing. Mm-hmm. She's a genius, and this little five-episode web series is one of my favorite things I've ever made. And so I just feel like we live in this era where you don't necessarily have to be a feature film person. You don't have to be a TV person. You just really, as a producer, I look for projects that interest me, and then the medium can be whatever is most appropriate for the story.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. And what is your, another thing we ask everyone here is your, misfit inspiration, your misspiration, if you will.
Oh, geez.
When you're in the lulls, like what is that book, that quote?
There's a quote that I'm going to botch. Hold on. I'm going to pull it up here. The wording, right? It's from a book of interviews from Neil Strauss, the journalist. Mm-hmm. So this was a quote that Neil Strauss saw hanging on the wall of folk singer James Talley's office, but it said, All things unfinished or in turmoil around me are reminders that I'm still alive. And so I'm one of these people that just constantly has a million different projects going on. They're all in different, you know, I'm writing songs for a PBS kid show right now because of the strike. I produce a show called City Island with Aaron Augenblick for PBS Kids. And I'm writing the songs this season, which is such a different
fun.
Like my career. And then, you know, and then next meeting will be like to produce a stand-up special for Netflix in Washington, D.C. and with like an A-list director. And so, you know, I there's never really any point where at any given time I'm like, I'm finishing this project and then I have a break and it's on to the next project. I always have a bunch of things in different states, and that's how I like it. And frankly, that's how things get made, because so many things do end up fizzling out or not moving forward. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the things that's unique about this business is I get to do many different things and work with many different people of varying skill sets, and things are constantly in turmoil.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how I know I'm alive. Yeah. And that's how I want to be until I retire.
Oh yeah. What is it like? You don't know if it's confirmed until after it happens. And then you're like,
yeah, that's a great quote.
And you're like, yeah, I got it from someone who did a solo show about being a celebrity hairdresser. Like, oh, wow. A bunch of years ago at like a fringe festival. I don't know who it is, but whoever you are out there, thank you for that quote. Yeah. That's the same.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I've learned now is like, you don't any green light. It's like until I'm on set shooting it, I don't know that it's happening. And even now, I mean, there've been obviously shows that have gotten shot and edited and delivered and have never seen the light of day because of tax write-offs. So these days, everything is just so uncertain. You just have to do your best to make the best stuff and hope that it will see the light of day.
So I have a question from one of my characters. We have Mae Musk is here.
Hello. You might know my son, Elon. Perhaps you know him from his... Everyone knows him. And perhaps he and I were on a Saturday Night Live. Did you see that?
I actually...
Like everything my son does, it was exceptional. It was the best Saturday Night Live episode ever in all time. He was so good. And the thing is, he's obsessed with jiu-jitsu. And he's going to break his neck, and then I'll have to hire someone to take me to the Met Gala with me. So listen, how can we get, what kind of show would you recommend for Elon? Have maybe a sketch show around Elon would help occupy his mind so he does not do jiu-jitsu. What kind of sketch show would you pitch?
I would say any sketch show that distracts him from working on whatever he's calling Twitter right now would be, benefit to all mankind.
We could be a sketch show about Twitter.
Sure. Keeps him from continuing to ruin it.
That's right. Whatever he wants to do, you know, he likes to play with his games and his rockets and his batteries. And so, maybe it could be a sketch show about a battery factory in Texas.
Perfect.
There we go. And then we could go from the different worlds, from the battery factory to the rocket space rocket factory. And back. All right. I'm going to pitch it to Elon. I've had enough of this jiu-jitsu thing with this Mark Zuckerberg, him and his mother. Mark Zuckerberg's mother and I have been planning this very intensely. We've had enough of that. Okay. All right.
You should do jiu-jitsu.
You should do jiu-jitsu.
Sure. I'll get on that.
Maybe well, you said you want to do jiu-jitsu?
I think that's all right. I'll probably pass on that.
Okay, all right. I think everyone should stop with jiu-jitsu and get to more sketch comedy. Thank you. Okay, all right. I'm going to go get in my Tesla rocket and go off shopping. Thank you. All right. That's May. All right. Cool. Well, I think she's ready to go pitch a new sketch show. So Elon gets out of trouble.
Sure. If he wanted one, he could have one. He has the money.
Yes. 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 Another endeavor to, I don't know, keep his mind occupied. After rockets and batteries, I guess he's bored.
He doesn't have enough to do.
Yeah, that's him. Cool. All right. Well, where can people come find you, follow you, etc.?
Oh, I used to have a Twitter presence. Now I've sort of stopped for obvious reasons that we just discussed. My Instagram's private. I would say, I don't know, we have a company website, ironypoint.com. You can check that out and check out the things we're working on. And we have a couple things that are on pause because of the strike, but hopefully next year we'll have some new things.
Yeah, and if there's a sketch comedy show that's really funny, you're probably behind it. So look out.
Very good. Say. I've been very lucky. I get pulled into a lot of.
Yeah, good. Well, bravo. All right. Well, thanks for coming to hang out.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logi. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogi.com. Thank you to Annie Mercutian for editing, Edward Silla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The proceeding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at RadioMisfits.com.